My name is Ray O'Keefe. I'm an alcoholic. I don't think that's Curtis's fault. I think he was born that way. Now, I've been asked here to talk about the 12 steps for the day. Don't get nervous. We'll be taking breaks, depending on how much coffee I drink and how it all comes out, so to speak. And they asked me to do this because I've been in Alcoholics Anonymous a long time. And you can tell by looking at me, I've been someplace for a long time. And before I talk about the steps, I'm going to tell you a story. It's a good story. It's a true story. And like all good true stories, it has a moral. And I like the way I tell it. And what it is the history of Alcoholics Anonymous. But it's not the history that we all know about that starts in 1935. My history starts long before that. I don't know when Alcoholics Anonymous was conceived. I have a hope and a belief that it was conceived somewhere in the vast reaches of time and also somewhere in the mind of God. A thought was to do something about this problem of alcoholism, this scourge that had been haunting man since pre-biblical times, actually. And so, in the early days of this century, and long before Akron, Ohio, a cast of characters in sort of a morality play began to assemble in a very, very nice town in Vermont, of all places. It's called Manchester, Vermont. Manchester, Vermont is a very beautiful town. It's a resort town. It's a picture postcard Vermont town with the church and the spires and all of that stuff. It's on the main road going north and south in Vermont, Route 7. I went to school up there, and I know the town pretty well. And down to Manchester, Vermont, from East Dorset, Vermont, about 12 miles up Route 7, before the Great War, the First War, came young Bill Wilson. And he came down from his home there, where he lived with his grandparents, his mother's people, the Griffins, to attend the prep school that they had in Manchester. And at the same time, for the summers at least, up from Brooklyn, New York, came a very lovely young girl named Lois Burnham with her father, Dr. Burnham, and they had a summer place there. And from Albany, New York, which is about 40 miles to the west on a straight line, came a man by the name of Edwin Thatcher, who was known to us as Ebby Thatcher. And his family were very prominent in Albany. His father had a very high-level accounting firm, CPAs. And they had a summer place over in this resort of Manchester, right on the main street, all beautiful Victorian homes. And also up from New York City by way of Newport, Rhode Island, came a rich guy by the name of Roland Hazard. And they all met and mixed before the war, the First War. And then the war came, and they dispersed. And as we know, Bill went into the Vermont National Guard, which was an artillery outfit, and he took his battery to France. And he performed well, and he was given an award by his men when it was all over. And when the war was over, they all came back and began to assemble. And Manchester, Vermont's got a very nice country club. And Bill Wilson always liked to hang out with people who had some dough. And so he hung around with this country club crowd, and Hazard had a big house, and Thatcher had a big house, and Lois was good looking, and everything was great. And then they went their way, as we all do with our childhood friends and our school friends. We all go our own way, ultimately. So Bill married Lois, and we all know he went to Brooklyn, and we'll get to him in a while. The first one to get in trouble with whiskey was Roland Hazard, the rich kid. And Roland was in a lot of trouble with whiskey, so much so his family had placed him in every sanitarium there was, and it did no good. Finally, they sent him to the great Carl Jung in Switzerland. And he stayed there a full year with Carl Jung, and at the end of the year, Jung said to him, "Well, we've done everything we can, and good luck to you." So Roland said, "I'm cured," and he took off. He left Dr. Jung, and he got as far as Paris. And somebody asked him the wrong question. They said, "Would you like a drink?" The only time I ever said no to that question, I completely misunderstood the question. So now he's rattling around Paris, stewed and drunk and disorderly and all the rest of it. So he says, "I got to get back to Dr. Jung." So he did. He went back to Dr. Jung, and Dr. Jung pronounced a death sentence on him. It's in our book. Jung says, "I have never seen an alcoholic of your type recover. First they go insane, and then they die." You know, if somebody tells you that, that gets your attention, huh? And of course, Roland said, "Is there no possible way out of this?" Jung said, "Once in a while, here and there, a phenomenon occurs with people who have a religious experience, and it produces in them some type of a displacement, which I'm trying to produce in you, but I failed. So if you can find a religious experience, maybe you can do something. But otherwise, you are dead." It's nice to have money. Money is a good thing to have. So Roland went out and bought himself a religious experience. He did. He found the Oxford Group, which was in those days a very active bunch, founded by a very charismatic gentleman from Pennsylvania named Buckman, and they characterized themselves as first century Christians. That is, they lived as did the Christians live in the first century after the death of Christ, and before there was an institutional church, before the church created bishops and cardinals and, you know, all that stuff. They just lived by Christian principles. They lived by four absolutes: absolute purity, absolute love, absolute honesty, absolute unselfishness. And Roland attached himself to these people, and every religious organization you ever know always welcomes rich people. You know, that's the way it works. So enthusiastic was Roland that he took his house in Manchester, Vermont, and made of it a commune, for an early commune. Now we're talking about 1931 and 2. Up in Vermont, he turns over his whole house for the Oxford groupers, and he's got 10 or 20 of them up there. They practice communal living. They had group confession. They confessed their faults to one another. They made amends for the harms they had done. They had closed meetings, they had open meetings, they had a lot of stuff that we inherited. Next comes Ebbie Thatcher. His family had exiled him from Albany. Now, if you've ever been in Albany, New York, to be exiled from such a dump as that is really bad. I mean, that's a real shit heap. And they exiled him from there because he was an embarrassment. And so he was over at the family home in Manchester, Vermont, drinking, of course, drunk. Came around a corner one night with his car, and he ended up in a farmer's kitchen. Vermonters are not known for their humor. And he stepped out of the car in a guy's kitchen and says, "Does anybody have a drink?" Not funny. Now he's in front of the judge, and the judge gives him the usual, "If I ever see you again, it'll go very hard for you, blah, blah, blah." I used to be a judge. I used to give the same speech. So he decides to reform himself and amend his ways and keep busy. So one of the things, you know how it is, to keep busy, we all did this, I did this. He decides to paint this house. These are these enormous Victorian homes. So he buys a gallon of paint and a brush and a ladder, and he starts to paint this house. Well, he's having trouble because he couldn't get above the third rung of the ladder without falling off because he's drunk and he, you know. So he did a little bit of the house, and then he decided to admire it, which is alcoholic. So he got a beach chair, and he put it on the lawn. Now he's on the main street of this town, and he's admiring the house. And a pigeon comes along and takes a shit on the paint, which gets Ebby very upset. So he goes in the house and gets his shotgun. And now he's shooting off this shotgun at birds on the main street of Manchester, Vermont. Now he's in front of the same judge. And the judge says, as judges do, one phone call. Now who would you call? He calls Roland Hazard, his friend with money. Roland comes, says to the judge, you give me him. I'll take him over to the commune. You'll never see him again. And he never did. And Roland took Ebby. Now Roland and Ebby are sober. And now the winter is coming. So it's not, Vermont's not the best place in the world to be. So around October, they both go down to New York City, where if you go there to this day, in the Calvary Church in the 30s down in the lower middle east side on New York, the main window you'll see has been donated in memory of the Hazard family. And Dr. Samuel Shoemaker was the rector of this church, a very early friend of AA, and a very early Oxford grouper. And this is now in 32, which is the height of our depression, and they're running a soup kitchen down there. It was very common. I'm from New York. It was very common all over to have soup kitchens, and it wasn't for the homeless. Good people, shirts and ties, going there to get a little food. And Ebby is on the line handing out the food. That was his job. Oxford grouper. Ebby says, while he was handing out the potatoes, one day a thought came to him. He don't know where it came from. The thought was, call up your friend Bill Wilson and see how he's doing. So, Ebby now, you know, he's full of the spirit. So he calls up his friend Wilson. Wilson, in our book, says, my old friend called me and said he was coming over. And I said, come right over. Wilson said, I imagine we were going to sit around and talk about the good old days. I had 3 quarts of gin, said Wilson. You know, they made their own gin in the bathtub in those days. And he said, we would talk about the time we went on that bender, and we'd talk about the time we chartered the airplane. This is all in our book. What happened was Wilson and Ebby were the first people to land at the Manchester, Vermont airport because they landed on it the day before it opened. And when they landed, they had a high school band out there practicing the opening ceremony, and these two got off the plane drunk, and the pilot was drunk, and they thought the high school band was performing for them. So they all stood at attention like they were back in the army in World War I, because they were thrown out of the airport as trespassers. And Bill thought they would sit around, you know, alcoholic bullshit. They would have a good time. And Bill said when he opened the door and he looked at Ebby, there was something different about Ebby. Something different. And Bill said to him, what happened to you? And Ebby said, I got religion. And Bill went, oh, Christ. That's what he says in our book. Last year, an alcoholic crackpot. This year, a religious crackpot. Brings Ebby in, and they sit down. Bill's working on a gin, and Ebby's working on Bill. And Ebby is full of that enthusiasm and the spirit, like you and I were when we were first members of AA. Remember, we were going to sober up the whole goddamn world, and our cousin Louie, and we were going to do this and that. And that's Ebby. He's full of it, brother, and he's pouring it on to Bill, and Bill doesn't want to hear a goddamn thing about it. Yeah, you know, yeah. And then Ebby gets into what Bill called a God business. And Bill said, it's in our book, I'm not much for that. You know, and Bill was not. He termed himself an agnostic. He called himself an agnostic. He preferred science. He preferred stuff like that. His heroes were not saints, they were physicists and chemists. And just, he thought of himself that way. Now, you know, thinking yourself is, doesn't make it so. And then Ebby said something that Bill put in our book in italics. because this is what got his attention. Ebbe said to him, you know, in this Oxford group that he's been talking about, he said, you form your own concept of God. Boom. The hook was in, Bill bit. I didn't stop drinking. Did not stop drinking. He got drunk. He went into town's hospital. Sukhoi told him about the disease. He had knowledge. He knew about the disease. He got drunk. Knowledge is not the answer. Knowledge doesn't, you know, awareness does not cure disease. This won't do it. We're all smart enough to know. Everybody in this room knew where you were before you got here. What was a big mystery to you? You're an alcoholic? No kidding. You mean because I drink 3 quarts of vodka a day, I'm an alcoholic? Yeah, that has something to do with it. I never would have known that. So what we know, you know, doesn't do anything for us. Finally comes the big time. Bill is in Towns Hospital for the last time that we all know about, October of 1934. And he says in our book, this is a big book, by the way. It's not the big book. It's a big book. And my sponsor gave me this first week I was here. He said, read the black part. Don't read this other stuff here. So this thing says, my friend came to visit me, Ebbe, while he was in Towns. And when my friend came to visit me, he said, I told my friend I was alcoholic and I could not manage my own life. I was going to stop drinking. I was going to make amends for the harm that I had done others. And I was going to try to live my life by principles. And my friend left me, Ebbe left him the book Variety of Religious Experience by James. And then Ebbe left. And when you turn the page, Bill has his experience. You know the remorse and the loneliness and the despair that comes with that withdrawing. You remember that? That's just, oh, brother, you know, and you will never forget it. Right? Right. And he's in the middle of that. And so he comes off the bed, he kneels on his floor, and he says, if there is a God, let him show himself now. Whereupon he says, the room lit up with a light so intense that he could no longer see the wall. And a wind blew through that room. And he said, in my mind's eye, I was lifted into another dimension where that wind blew. And it lasted for a while. And he came out of it. And of course, he sent for Silkworth. And he said, am I crazy? Because he knew he had withdrawn before. He knew about DTs. He knew about hallucinations. Silkworth said, I wasn't here. I don't know what happened to you, but you look a little better now. A lot better now than you did a few hours ago. So whatever happened to you, you better do something with it. Best he could do. Now Bill comes out of the hospital, and he starts working with the soup kitchen. He's down there with Ebbe and Roland. They're all handing out the food. And Bill is trying to get people sober because he told Ebbe he would help alcoholics. And, of course, there are a lot of alcoholics coming through the line. Plus, in that area down there on the east side, there's a bar on every corner, maybe two or three. So Bill's going into the bar trying to get people to... And the thing he's telling them is, his room lit up. Now, if you're standing at a bar, especially in New York City, which is a little different, right? I don't want to be indelicate. You know what the New York City attitude is? I use bad language sometimes. Here's the New York City attitude, and you can check me on this. The tourist says to the guy from New York, can you tell me how to get to the Statue of Liberty, or should I just go fuck myself? That's the New York attitude. So here are these guys drinking in this bar, and here comes this tall, skinny dink of water from Vermont, and he wants to tell him his room lit up. You know? You know the New York tattoo? Here, light this up, Charlie. Get out of here. So he went back up to Silkworth at Towns, and he said, I'm running around the saloons. I'm running around the soup kitchen. I'm telling everybody my room lit up. Nobody's paying any attention to me. And so I said, of course they're not. Nobody cares your room lit up. They think you're crazy. Tell them what I told you. First and last time before his room lit up, Silkworth got Lois in Bill's room and said to Lois, he's got to go. He needs long-term care. They're going to put him in Rockland State Hospital and let him go crazy, because if he doesn't, he's going to die. And then after 5 years, maybe we'll take him out again and take a look at him. But he's got to go. He's all finished. And Bill heard that. And Silkworth said, tell him what I told you and Lois. You got to go. What Dr. Jung told Roland Hazard, you're going to die. That's the message. That gets people's attention. You're going to die, Charlie. Never mind, you know, what you should do and you shouldn't do, your family, no family. You're going to die. Now he's got this deal. Now he's in Akron, Ohio. And now it's Saturday of Mother's Day weekend in 1935. Everybody's gone home. Bill has not gone home because he don't have the money to go home. He can't buy a ticket. He hasn't paid for his hotel bill. His friend said they were going to pay for it. He's got $10, which in 1935 is like having $100. He's also getting thirsty because he's an untreated alcohol. He's nervous. He's irritable. He's discontent. He hears the bar on the main floor of the Mayflower Hotel. I think it was a gay bar. Our book says he heard that gay crowd inside. So here's our beloved sponsor, and he says to himself, I'm going to go in there and have a ginger ale and maybe strike up an acquaintance for the weekend. You know, dance backwards or something. I'm playing Immies in the Bronx. This bastard's got my life in his hands, and he wants to go drink ginger ale in a bar? What the hell kind of shit is that? Now, listen to what this tells you. Here's a guy, 6 months before, had God in his room. Correct? Here's a guy who had Almighty God in his room in November. And now it's May, and he wants to go in a bar and get drunk. So much for spiritual experiences, huh? God just goes so far with you. So then he starts making phone calls. Now here's something that they just published the last time. I knew it for a long time, but they just put it into passing on. Henrietta Seibeling was the estranged daughter-in-law of the Seibeling family. Seibeling had been chairman of the board of Goodyear, and they were very, very prominent in Akron, Ohio, big rubber town. And his son, no, it wasn't Goodyear, it was Firestone. His son was a boozer, and so she left him. But they let her stay in the guest house, which was considerable on the Firestone estate. So Bill gets a hold of a clergyman who's an Oxford grouper, Amos Tunk, and he gets a hold of Henrietta. Now, Henrietta was a member of the Oxford group of Akron, Ohio, and so was Dr. Bob Smith and his wife, Anne. It was the custom of the Oxford group to confess their faults to one another every month. In the month of May of 1935, Bob Smith stood up at the first meeting of the Oxford group in Akron, Ohio, and he said, I have a drinking problem. And they all knew it, but this was the first time that Bob had ever asked for help. And under their practice in the Oxford group, every member, there were only 11 of them, agreed that every morning they would get on their knees and ask God to send help for Dr. Bob. Mother's Day, as you know, is the third week in May. Every morning from May 1st to this day, Henrietta's on her knees every morning saying to God, send help for Bob. Now the phone rings, somebody she never heard of. He says, I'm from New York. My name is Wilson. I fix drunks. And she says, of course you do. Of course you do. Come out here right away. I got one for you. See? Henrietta was a woman of faith. She believed. There was no surprise to her. She knew that phone was going to ring. She didn't know when. She didn't know who. She knew it was going to ring. Because she was committed to the Oxford group. She believed. So she said, come on out. So out comes Wilson with his $10. She talks to him for a while to find out if he's really crazy or what. She determines he's not nuts. She calls up Ann Smith. She said, bring your husband over here. Well, it was a Saturday, a Mother's Day. Bob had come home drunk, of course, with a large potted plant he got someplace. He gave it to her, and he passed out. She says, he's more potted than the plant. And he's under the table. I can't get him up. So, you know, you don't want to wake up a sleeping drunk, right? Just let him lie. So Henrietta says, bring him out tomorrow morning. So tomorrow morning comes, and Bob says, I'll give this guy from New York, that's how they talk about Wilson in Akron, Ohio, that guy from New York, 15 minutes. And they went out, and they spent 5 hours. And I don't know if you ever saw that television program with James Garner and James Woods. And James Garner is Dr. Bob, and James Woods is Bill. It was a good program. It was about 5 years ago. It was called Bill W. And they described this meeting and Woods is talking as Bill Wilson to Dr. Bob. And Dr. Bob, and that smarmy medical doctor ego stuff, says, just what is it, Mr. Wilson, that you think you can do for me? And Wilson says, I'm not here for you. I'm here for me. So he tells Bob what Silkworth told him. He says to Bob, you're going to die. Bob's a physician. He should have, 5 hours later, and Bob says to him, here's an important thing. Bob says to Bill, I'll do everything you ask me to do, except I can't make amends. I am a physician. I am a doctor. I can't be driving around Akron, Ohio. It's a small enough town. We call him a surgeon. He was a proctologist. He worked on people's asses, which is not a bad specialty if you're going to hang around with a lot of alcoholics, I'll tell you. Well, Bob says to Bill, I'll do everything you say, but I can't drive around Akron, Ohio and make amends. I can't do that. I just can't. I'm a doctor. I can't go around telling people that I harm them. I won't do it. Bill says, listen, maybe you can do the best you can, but it's not going to work unless you do it all. Bob says, we'll see. So we saw Bob a week later goes to Atlantic City and gets drunk. Now he's back. His nurse's husband finds him in a saloon, drags him back to the nurse's house, throws him on a couch, and calls his wife. And, of course, Wilson by now has moved in and is living in the house there. And they said, we got Bob. He's stewed. So Wilson said, I'll be over in the morning. So on June 10th, 1935, Bill goes over, gets Bob, gives him 2 bottles of beer, 2 goofballs at Bobichwitz that they used to eat in those days, and Bob went up the Akron Hospital, worked on some guy's ass. And Bill went back to the house, and Bob didn't get home till midnight. And Bill said, where you been? You know, they're worried about him, thought he's drunk. Ann thought he's drunk. Bill, everybody thought he was drunk. He said, I've been driving around Akron, Ohio, making amends. See? They put a line in our book. At some of these steps, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. The results were nil until we let go, and let go, absolutely. That came right from Dr. Bob. See, this book is a book of experience. This is not a scholarly, academic treatise on what we hope will work. The pamphlet, the best pamphlet we have, A Member's View of Alcoholics Anonymous, refers to this, and it says, it is a report of action taken. That's why all these steps are written in the past tense. It is a report of action taken. They did these things. These are the steps we took. which are suggested as a program of recovery. That's what they say. Now, I submit to you that that history that I just described to you shows that beyond any doubt, if I had to prove this in a court of law, beyond any doubt, this program is ordained from time immemorial. And that what we're talking about in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is not the issue of stopping drinking. We are talking about searching, seeking for a relationship with God. And that's what it's about. It's not about drinking or not drinking. It's about seeking and searching for a relationship with God. And that's my agenda. And that's what I promote. And that's what I'll be talking about for most of this day. Our book says to us, in the fifth chapter that's read at most meetings, most places, it says at the end of that reading that the chapters that go before and our personal adventures make clear three pertinent ideas. Pertinent means material, important ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that no human power could relieve our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he was sought. So it's a question of seeking, not finding, seeking God. Now don't tell me you don't believe in God, because that has nothing to do with it. You don't believe in a lot of shit. I don't care what you believe in. I got a guy now in sponsor, he's an atheist. He tells me that. He's an atheist. He's full of shit, but he's an atheist. I said, good, you're an atheist? Yeah. I said, you want to get sober? He said, yeah. I said, good. Now, every morning, I want you to say this. I am an atheist. I do not believe in God. I am an alcoholic. I need help. And at the end of the day, if you're still sober, you say, thank you very much. He says, who am I talking to? I said, what do you give a shit who you're talking to? who cares what you're talking to, stupid? You are an alcoholic. Without help, it is too much for you. Now, do you want the help? You don't want the help. Oh, yeah. I said, well, you can be an IP, anything you want. Tell them, I'm an atheist. I don't believe. We come here with all this stuff, you know, it's barroom bullshit. Just forget about that. Forget about it. It has nothing to do with anything. Now, I'll be doing this a lot. Usually when I do these, the steps are right behind me. If you read this thing behind me, you see what it says? It says, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, zip, that our lives had become unmanageable. Now, there's no big words in there. No big words like elephant or anything like that. It's all in the English language. Not a big deal. And let me tell you, when I do these steps, I'm not here to teach you anything. I'm not. I'm a teacher. That's my job. But I'm not here to teach you anything. I'm not here to preach at you, although sometimes it sounds like that even to me. What I bring to this is experience. My sobriety date is November 24, 1965. And it is fair for me to say, people who know me will tell you, that I have been at a meeting every day since, barring hospitals and, you know, earthquakes and stuff. And I came in to Alcoholics Anonymous twice. I came the first time in 63. I didn't make it. I came again in 65, and I've been here since that day. And I had a sponsor, and I have a home group, and that's why I'm sober, because of those two things. And I had a sponsor. I don't talk about drinking much because I don't think it has much to do with anything. And I drank the same way you drank, and I felt the same way you felt, and I did the same things you did. And, you know, there's only one story in AA. Why are we bothered telling each other? I really don't know. It's all the same old stuff. You know, we all start, and we all screw it up, and then we all got here. So a lot of people misread this big book. I don't know why, but it's very simple. A lot of people say that the book says that I'm supposed to tell you what it was like, what happened, what it's like now. Wrong. The book says, in when we speak in a general way, we say what we were like, what happened, and what we are like now. Not what it was like. You know what it was like, right? It was shit on a stick. Is that what it was? Do I have to tell you what it was like? You can tell me. You know, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about my relationship with God. And I speak to you without a religious base. I'm not a member of any church. I don't go to church. I got nothing against church. I just don't go. It doesn't interest me. This interests me. I go to meetings. And that's what I bring here. I bring experience. You can't go to that many meetings for that many years without something rubbing off. And this first word and the first step is very important to me, anyhow, this we. Because I was never part of that in my whole life. It was never we. It was me. Me. Self-absorbed, self-selfishness, self-centeredness. This is the cause of our problems. It's his selfishness. That's me. Me. Spiritual constipation. Too much me unpassed. You know, a guy came in the bar and said to me, my mother died. Your mother died? Oh, that's too bad. Can you lend me $25? I need the money. Your mother died? What the hell do I care? Your mother died. You want me to bring her back to life? Give me them. I need money. I'm totally self-absorbed. I was never part of anything. And I heard Conway last night, I've heard it before, it's true with me. I've heard every alcoholic I've ever known say this. I never felt like I belonged anywhere. I never fit. I never had a father. I had an alcoholic mother. I found out about 4 years ago I'm from a dysfunctional family. I think I made it dysfunctional. And we lived in the South Bronx, and there were five of us, and we lived in three rooms, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they drank. Everybody drank. And when I was a kid, during the time that Bill Wilson was trying to get sober, they had a keg of beer in the bathtub in our house, my apartment, and they'd be having this party going on all the time, and I'd be hiding under a table trying to read my book so I wouldn't get killed. These people step on me. And I knew that I didn't belong with that crowd. I didn't belong there. What the hell am I doing here? I'm trapped. Little kid, I'm trapped with these lunatics. And then they sent me up to those schools, and they were good schools. I have nothing against those schools. They were great schools, the Catholic schools. I got an education from first grade through law school free. Never had to pay for anything. Very, very good to me. That crowd, but I felt crazy up there. You know, I'm up there with these people. I know what they're talking about. And they're a scary bunch, I tell you. And I was the best student they ever had in every school I was ever in. And even so, I did not fit in. When I was 26, I was professor of law at a big law school, Fordham University School of Law, Fordham, New York City. I don't know what the hell I'm doing there. How did I get here? What am I supposed to do now? So I had to quit drinking. I said, Jesus Christ, you know, this is some job. I better quit drinking. I drank more when I quit drinking than I was when I was drinking. So he said, have a drink. I said, I'm not drinking. Give me a beer. Yeah, and I drank more trying to not drink than I did when I drank. So I'm going nuts. And when you're a professor of law, you know, there's a certain amount of mystique and prestige to it all, and I'm one now. But you can't walk into the faculty lounge and say, anybody get locked up last night? Did you piss in your pants, professor? Did I see a little pee there? They say, who is that? Take him away. Get the police. So I'm in there and I'm hiding. I got a big office. I got to close, keep the door closed. Everybody's got their door open. I got my door closed because I'm drinking in it. I don't fit in there. It's 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm in some saloon on the Lower East Side, and the guy next to me is spitting on my shoe, and I'm drinking a shot and a beer, and I'm saying to myself, Professor, I don't think you belong here. Why don't you go home? Well, I didn't belong up there either. I had a very nice house, a very nice town, had a bar in my house. A lot of booze in my house. A lot of kids in my house, so 7 children. Nice wife in my house. You're going to hear it tonight. I don't belong up there either. I just don't belong. I don't belong. And then I come here. Christ, I fit like a glove. Just boom. Here I am. You know, it isn't so much they ask me to do all of this, which is a great honor and all the rest of it. I belong here. You know? I'm supposed to be here. This is what I'm supposed to be doing now. This. I belong. It's okay for me to be here. I don't need your permission or anything. I'm just here. That's all. And I got that we here. I never had anywhere else. I tried to stop drinking by myself. We all did. I drank more. When I drank less, I drank more. I'm going to stop drinking. Well, not right away, for Christ's sake. You know, the world that wasn't built in a day. I mean, think about this. Buy 3 quarts. I think I'll have a drink. Okay? Then I get 3 quarts. I don't want to do it. Till the weekend, anyhow. And that's the first thing, was they had to come together. Wilson never made it without Bob. Wilson was sitting on his ass, thinking he was drinking until he ran into Bob that day. Bob never could do a thing until he met Wilson. They were each as important to each other as you are to me, as I am to you. As we are together. In front of every step, I put the word we. It's we. It's you and it's me. Without you, I am one dead duck. And without me, who knows? I didn't come here to become a Christ-like figure or a great spiritual giant. It just sort of worked out that way. And what is it that we did? We admitted that we were powerless over alcohol. That's what we did. Now, that doesn't say we said we drank too much or anything else. We were powerless. That means no power, without power. It's not a question of drinking more or drinking less. That's not the issue. The book says that you and I are suffering from a dilemma. Here's the dilemma. Lack of power. That is our dilemma. It says lack of power. We must have a power greater than our own, which will enable us to lead our lives. It has nothing whatever to do with drinking. It has to do with looking for power. And the book goes on to say, there is one who has all power. May you find him now. That's what it says. And that's what this program is about, is a search for that relationship of God. Our book tells us at another point very early on when it describes what the book is about. It says, in the back of this book, you are going to find stories of individuals who will explain to you how they established their relationship with God. Now, isn't that strange language? Shouldn't it say you will find stories of people who will tell you how they stopped drinking? No. How they established their relationship with God. That's what it's all about. Now, don't become concerned. It goes on, it tells us we are not saints. We are not saints. What the hell would we do with a saint here? Where will we put him? I don't want him next to me. Jesus, things are tough enough sometimes. We don't have any saints here. We don't even have nice guys who drink too much here. What will we do with them? You know what nice guys who drink too much should do? They should drink. What else? So why do you do that for? Hey, he's a nice guy, he just drinks them. That's not us. At one point, alcoholism was known as Jelinek's disease. Dr. Jelinek was the first real scientist on alcoholism. He ran the Yale School of Alcoholic Studies in New Haven. And Jelinek decided he would become an alcoholic. So he'd have first-hand experience. So he went out and he told his people in the lab, I'm going to become an alcoholic. So they said, good for you. So he went out and he bought himself some booze. And he brought it back to the laboratory and he started drinking. He had about a pint in him when he got stewed, started to talk like a fool, fell off his chair, hit his head, bounced off the floor, crapped in his pants, and then took a little snooze, you know. Well, about 3 hours later, he woke up, and he said to the lab guys, "I'll never have another drink of that shit for the rest of my life." And they said, "Good," and he never did. Now, that's not us. We be crawling around that floor. Where the hell did I leave that bottle? What's that stuff in my pants? Ah, well, I'll worry about that later. Where's the bottle? All right, we're in there at 5 o'clock in the morning to the guy, open up this dump, you know. You got any of that stuff left? You know that stuff. The stuff took away my driver's license, my marriage license, my license to practice law, my house, my money, my kids, my car. You got anything left? I'll have a triple. Put it in a twist. That's us. See, that's not a nice guy who drinks so much. That's us. Sick, desperate alcoholics. Powerless. Powerless. We can't not drink. That's all. Now, our book tells us how we ought to handle this. It says, concede to our innermost self that we are alcoholics. That's what it says in the third chapter. Concede to your innermost self. Now, what is your innermost self? That's your spirit. That's your innermost self. This magnificent structure that I present to you this morning, this is my outermost self. My innermost self is in there, and that's where I live. And that's where you live. You live in your innermost self. That's you. This is nothing. You know, I know, this is going to go. Christ is half gone now. I think it's ruined right this minute. We know it's gone. Not you, Gert, but the rest of us. It's gone. And so this can't be me. This is this. I don't know, a spiritual being encased in a physical body, or a physical being encased in a spiritual, I can't remember. But we know this is not it. And that's not where the concession is made. The concession is made here where we live. And that's why this is a spiritual body. Some people say the first step is physical. No, no. No, no. We don't have any physical step. We don't have anything physical around here. We don't have any leafy green diets, broccoli, aerobics, that kind of shit. Some people do that. That's nice. That's not part of our program. This is an interior program. It is all interior. It's all inside. It's all in the spirit. It is spiritual. It is spiritual. On the anniversary of the 25th anniversary of AA, this summer they reprinted in the Grapevine the correspondence between Bill Wilson and the great Carl Jung, which I have here in another volume. And Bill Wilson wrote to Jung on the occasion of our 25th birthday in 1970, would they be 35 and 25? And he thanked him for what he told Roland. Because he said what you told Roland brought Roland to Ebby, brought Ebby to Bill, and started the chain reaction. And Bill sent a letter, and on January 30th, 1961, Carl Jung, who died just a year later, speaking of Roland, said this: his craving for alcohol was the equivalent on a low level of the spiritual thirst of our being for wholeness, expressed in medieval language, the union with God. See? Roland's craving for alcohol was an expression of his desire for union with God, to be whole, to be a whole person of the spirit. Now, Conway last night said that there was something in him missing. Remember when, in the beginning, he said there was something missing in him, this ability to be part of something. And that is true of myself, and I think it's true of all of us. You know, I'm supposed to tell you by tradition that I only speak for myself and I don't speak. I don't really believe that. I'm telling you the goddamn truth here. So you best pay attention. I was born with a piece missing. Truly so. There was a part of me missing that really would not allow me to relate to you. You know? I just couldn't be interested in you. I just couldn't care for you. I was missing. I didn't have it. I couldn't link up with anybody. It's like I was supposed to have a hook here where I could hook up with. I couldn't do that. I always went my own way. You know? I spent a lifetime being surrounded by assassins and assholes. And they were never as smart as me, and I was waiting for them to catch up, those idiots. And that included a lot of my teachers, and it made things, you know, difficult. And it contributed to this disaffection, dis-ease. Silkworth says of me, and it's very true, and when Silkworth writes in our book about the alcoholic, the doctor's opinion, he's writing about the alcoholic who's not drinking. He's not writing about a drunken alcoholic. We know about drunken alcoholics. That's nothing. He's talking about alcoholics who don't drink. Me. And he says of me, he is nervous, irritable, and discontented until he can once again experience that elusive feeling that comes immediately after a few drinks. Drinks which he sees other people taking without promise. That's me. Nervous, irritable, discontented. Nothing was ever good enough. I'm in the wrong goddamn family. It's a hassle. I wanted your mother. I wanted your father. I'm getting shit for Christmas. Crap for Easter. Nobody gives a shit. I'm nervous, I'm irritable, I'm discontent. That's a hassle. And now I'm about 13 years old. Somebody says, here, O'Keefe, try this. Yeah? Yeah. All right. Boom! It's okay. Christmas was okay. That's a nice school. It's all right. I don't know. It's okay to go there. You got any more of that shit? Give me some more. Yeah. This is pretty good. And we say of ourselves, really, in those early days, he's feeling good. Probably for the first time in 13 years, I'm feeling good. I feel good. It's okay. I don't have a father. Yeah, it's all right. I'll get along without a father. It's okay, I got a drunken mother. She does the best she can, and she did the best she could with what she had, which was nothing. My brother's great. My sisters are okay. Give me some more of that stuff. You're a nice girl. I think I love you. Yeah? Give me some more. And what it is for the first time in my life, I feel good. Why the hell wouldn't I get some more of that stuff? So from then on, I never let up. Good, better, best, right? The trouble is, I'm dealing with an addictive substance, which means that the more I take, the less it does for me. So I got to chase it. You know, where it did it with one, then it needed two, then it needed four, then it needed six. And alcohol is a low, slow-acting drug. Other drugs we see now are very fast-acting. Alcohol is a slow-acting thing. Most of the alcoholics take 20 years to get here. Crack cocaine, you're here in a week. Much different deal. I'll get to that later. But why wouldn't I want to feel good? Of course. Of course. But you see, what happens is, and this is in everyone's story, we go over it. We just do it too much. That's all. It's this seeking wholeness in Dr. Jung's sense. Wholeness. Entirety. This piece is missing. I'm trying to fill up. I've heard it described in so many ways. I'm trying to fill up that empty hole down here somewhere. You know that emptiness? And that's the place where the wind blows. the wind blows, and it makes the days very long, and it makes the nights very dark, and that wind howls down there. Jack London, the great writer, alcoholic, died, suicide, 40 years old, wrote to his pal Jack Barrymore, alcoholic, as one alcoholic with another, you know, there's a way they communicate. And London wrote to Barrymore, London called alcohol, for some reason, the noseless one. That's what he called alcohol in his literary. And he said, Jack, the noseless one came last night and took my soul away. And that's what it is, see? This stuff that we put in there takes our soul away. And this program gives it back to us. This union with God. And that's what it's about. And that's why the concession in the first step is to the innermost self. To your spirit, where you live, where you are, who you are. That's not very much to do with drinking. Oh, of course, if you knew, that's the rule. Don't drink, go to meetings. That's the first rule. It's the 1,000th rule. It's the 5,000,000th rule. But there's so much more to it than that. Don't drink, go to meetings. Very, very important. But that's like, you know, if you're invited to a banquet and you show up and you have an olive and a piece of radish and you go home, and you don't wait for them to bring out the good stuff, the prime ribs and the potatoes that are coming later. You take what you want and say, that's enough. I go home, I had my radish, I had a piece of celery. That's the equivalent of stopping drinking and leaving here because it's not drinking. And if you stop drinking and leave here, you'll drink again. And our book says if we drink again, we will surely die. But when we are into this business of the spirit, if I give talk at speaker meetings, I put it in a way, this way I put it, and this seems to me, I'm going to enforce my opinions on you all day long, but I usually tell you when it's going to happen. It seems to me that there's a time for all of us. And it seems to me that there is a time for each of us. I say to you that there is a line somewhere beyond which we are not permitted to go. And I say to you that there is a point somewhere below which we are not permitted to sink. And it seems to me that there is a level of pain somewhere beyond which no human is required to endure. Now, I don't know where this line is for you. I only know what happened to me. And this is an individual and a personal thing. And I think it is different in each case. But that line is there somewhere. And we all come to it in our own time and in our own way. And it's called by a variety of names, and most people call it the bottom. And as we know, it's a movable things, so people have more than one. It's all very mysterious. But there has to come a point where you admit to your innermost self and concede to your innermost self that you are powerless over alcohol. Without that, the rest is conversation. If this first step is not experienced, it's conversation, because you will surely drink again. And that's the way it is. It is a 100% thing. If there is a reservation, if you make a reservation, if you say, well, I will do this, go this far, but that's as far as I can go, you will drink again. At some of these we balked, There is, you know what's the easier, softer way? This is the easier, softer way. The 12 steps are the easier, softer way. We're not talking here about a big deal. I'm not talking about a big deal. I get a little dramatic about it. That's what I am. There are no mountains to climb here. Rarely have we ever seen anyone fail who has thoroughly followed our path. We're not climbing a mountain, we're following a path. A path is not difficult. Boopity boopity boop. And when you see a path, if you're walking along and you see a path, you know immediately that that path has been made by the steps of people who have taken that path. That's what a path is. It's worn down by the steps of people who have been there. That's what we're on. Not a mountain to climb or to fall off. It's not the goddamn Alps. We put our steps where they put their steps. Now, if this is so, and I say it's so, then the best thing you can have is someone who knows the path, knows how to go along, and even more importantly, knows where it comes out. That's our sponsor. See? And he says, look out here. That's a little tricky. It's a fourth step. Got to do this. Plus, he knows where we're going, because he's been. And that's what he shares, and that's why I'm here, to share experience, strength, and hope. It is the experience that gives us the strength. And it is the strength that gives us the hope. And that's something that when I drank, I never had any hope. I knew it was just too goddamn bad. I knew what I had. My whole family had it. I'm the only O'Keefe male to make age 50. I knew what I had. There was no mystery about it. I knew I was an alcoholic, and I knew what an alcoholic was, and I knew what happened to them. I've been to the funerals. We used to make a joke of it. Yeah, doesn't he look good? He stopped drinking. Yeah, that's the way the Irish used to do it. Charlie looks great. He stopped drinking. Arr. The Irish are very fun. Have a good time at funerals. Everybody gets drunk. The women hang around the coffin. The men go over to the saloon, get stewed, tell lies to each other about how slick they are. I put up with that crap. I listened to all of it. I went to all the funerals. I knew what was coming. I had a brother 4 years older than I am. If you put us next to each other, you wouldn't take us for brothers. He was Billy. Was a Marine, 30-year Marine. He looked like a 30-year Marine. He was rugged. You know, he had Silver Star, 3 Purple Hearts, a real Marine. So they called me one night from the vet's hospital in Minneapolis. He was dead. 44, alcohol. My brother Billy doesn't drink anymore. Tough way to stop. World War II didn't get him, Korea didn't get him, the booze got him. I was in Minneapolis about 3 weeks ago talking to one of these things, and I went to the, over there, I've been there before. They have a water system now, goes around this, that's, you know, military cemetery, all the headlines, everything's the same. There's a water system, comes off a lake next to it, a Fort Snelling in Minneapolis, and they pump the water into the lake for the grass, and it's not potable. And they have a spigot right at Billy's corner. My brother's got a corner plot. And it's got a military white with black letters. You know what it says? Don't drink. The water's no good for drinking. It's for the grass. Poor Billy O'Keefe. For all time. Don't drink. I was with this other guy from AA. He said, look at this shit here. Omens, eh? But see, I knew all of that. And so I had no hope. There was no way out of this. Yeah, and if I gave it any thought at all, I guess what I thought was, well, it's your turn now, Rary. You're in it, and you're not going to get out of it. And there's no way to go. Now, I came here in 63. I was a professor of law. I was a tenured professor of law, and I got fired. That's impossible. You know, you got to kill the dean right at his desk, chop his head off. I got fired. In 1959, I was the youngest tenured professor of law in the United States. Out, 62. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I stayed 10 months. It was all right, you know, it was okay. It was all right. Nice people. They did the best they could with what they had. I went when it was convenient, you know, if there wasn't something else to do. I dropped in. I was going to help them all. Because I didn't have a job, I didn't have any money, and I was full of shit, but that was irrelevant. And then somebody asked me the same question they asked Ebby. Have a drink, professor? Certainly, you know. So I got drunk and I stayed drunk until 65. And the last 3 months that I drank, basically I lived in a car. And there was no hope. There was just no way out. I'd gone just too far. My brother used to live on the Bowery. You know, he lived on the street, and he got a vet's check, and it went to my sister, and she sent it to him if she could find him. Otherwise, she just held it till he showed up or else. I sort of envied him, you know. He didn't have to get a shirt and a tie, make believe he was something else. He was just a full-time drunk. I had to make believe I was a lawyer. I had to make believe a lot of things, and all I was a drunk. So there was no hope. Plus, I failed at this. And when you fail at this, there really is no hope. Can you get me a cup of coffee? Black with a sweet milk. So here's what happened. I'm around now the second time. I have a sponsor. I have a group. I'm going to these meetings. I'm a goddamn nervous wreck. And every day I want to drink. Oh, Christ, that I want to drink. I need to drink. I got to have a drink. This is something's gone on too far now. And one day I wake up. I'd gotten a job. I was a lawyer. I had an office in New York City. And I went into New York on a train. And I went to Grand Central, and I connected there, and I went over, walked up to my building, got my office, closed the door, sat down, looked out the window, and then it hit me. I didn't think of a drink that morning. Now, the day before, I wanted a drink so bad I could taste it. And I got into bed that night, and I went, Jesus, another day, brother, that's all right. But this day, I didn't think about drinking at all. It wasn't I was going to drink or not drink. I just didn't think of drinking. It was startling to me. So I called up my sponsor. I said, John, I didn't think about drinking today. Thanks. He said, congratulations. I hung up the phone. We were very close. He was some sponsor boy. I'd say to him, I don't feel good. He'd say, well, this may be as good as you'll ever feel. I'd say, when am I going to get a good job? He said, you had one. I said, well, stop the bullshit now. When am I going to get a good job? He said, when you're ready. I said, well, how will I know I'm ready? He said, you'll have a good job. I said, I'm a nervous wreck. What the hell do you think I should do? He said, hold on. I said, well, how do you hold on? He said, let go. This is what I'm dealing with here, you know. It's like a Zen master. And I sat there for about another 10 minutes. I was startling. I did not think of a drink. I thought maybe it was a fluke, you know. But I went up that night to my meeting. I told the guys up there, there were 8 guys, 1 woman. That was our group. I didn't think of a drink. And I said, that's good, good. It's beginning to work. John was there. He said, that's true. It's beginning to work for you. And, you know, I haven't had a thought of a drink since. And it isn't that I ever gave it up. It's, the book says we didn't give up drinking. It doesn't exist for us. The book says put the drink problem aside. Let's get on with this now. And that's when I knew. I thought to myself, holy shit, let's see. I live in the same house. I live with the same people. I work in the same business. I'm still a lawyer. I live in the same town. I got the same car. Things are a little better. The only different thing is I go to an AA meeting every night. There is something in that AA meeting. There's a connection or something in that AA meeting that takes people like me and makes them not want to drink. Brother, what's that? Power. That's what that is. That's power. And that's certainly a power greater than my own, greater than your own, greater than our own. Sure it is. A lot of people in the second step, they get all hung up about God. If you see this behind me in the step, doesn't say the first thing, does it say anything about God? Nothing. We agree on something here. This is very simple. Before there was a second step, there was no second step. Bill Wilson had enough clout, he could probably have written anything that made any sense at all, get it through the gang, right? He could have written, "We all believed in God." Well, it wasn't true. They didn't all believe in God. More than half of them did not believe in God. Says that in our book. Half of our original number did not believe in God. And there's no requirement in this thing that you believe in God. I tell my atheists, you don't have to believe in God. Nobody gives a shit what you believe in. You think I care what you believe? What the hell is, what kind of ego is that, that I give a shit for you? Believe what you want. I don't care what you believe. The second step says we came to believe that. See, it's a proposition. It doesn't say believe in anything. We came to believe that. Here's the proposition. A power greater than our own. That's easy. I'm powerless. Could. Not would. Could. Restore us to sanity. There's something wrong with that. And that's what happened to me. All of a sudden, I don't want to drink. That's power. Now look, see this? I don't know what this is. This is light, power. Where this comes from, I have no idea. Whether there's atomic energy out there somewhere, or a steam turbine, or a waterfall, or the old Georgia Jekyll Rivers running around, or they got them hooked up to the hotel across the street if they're real smart. Well, what the hell difference does it make? What do I have to know that for? Right? I don't have to know where the power comes from. What I have to know is there's a switch right by the door over there. And if I hit that switch, this room will light up and be full of power. You know what the switch is? The AA meeting. That's where the power is. In the AA meeting, we. There's something about this when you and I come together that kicks off power. The same power that went to Dr. Bob from Bill. In the edition, the third edition to this, the introduction, it says Alcoholics has not changed, Anonymous has not changed from the very first. Recovery begins when one alcoholic talks to another. That's what it says, and it's true. And now I'm not thinking about drinking. And all of a sudden, bing, hope. I say to myself, maybe I can get sober. I hope I can get sober. I want to get sober. And then, you know, experience comes in. The next day, I didn't think about drinking either. And the book says, the drink problem falls from us. No? We don't fight anything, it says, including liquor. It's not a problem. And at this part of the book, it says, put aside the drink problem. It's not important. And believe, and I believe, and it isn't necessary. It isn't necessary for me to define this power. It isn't necessary for me to give it a name. It isn't necessary for me to dress it up in some particular way. It isn't necessary even for me to imagine what it might look like or be like. I experience it. You understand? It's not that somebody like me talked to me about it. I read it in a book. No. Here's the thing. On Tuesday, I wanted to drink so bad that I would have killed somebody if I could figure out a way to drink and not get in all that trouble. And the only thing that kept me from drinking on Tuesday was I was afraid. Fear kept me from drinking on Tuesday. And on Wednesday, I don't want to drink at all. I mean, I don't think about it. It's not an issue. I'm not thinking about drinking, and I'm not thinking about not drinking. And I think I spend more time thinking about not drinking than drinking. I can't drink, I can't drink, I won't drink. Now I don't have to worry about that shit. It's not in my head anymore. I can get on with what I'm supposed to worry about. How to get on. How to get sober. How to get be part of this thing. And I said, brother, and that's all I needed. That's all I needed. I went to him. Oh, I'll tell you, this sponsor of mine, I talk about him all the time. He's such a pain in the ass. I said, John, what's a power greater than our own? He said, a power greater than our own is a power greater than our own. I felt like Moses. You remember Moses? Moses one day was talking to a burning bush. What are you laughing about? The guy was talking to a burning bush.